Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to talk about the world of insects today with our guest entomologist, Phil Pelletieri. Back to talk about the bugs to be looking out for in the fall. We can talk about magnolia scale, those fall swarming ants, fall sawflies on pines, and a whole bunch more. And certainly looking forward to your questions as well. What bug questions do you have for Phil? Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And certainly we'd love to hear from you. And Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great, and you sound like you're doing fine, too. And we talk a lot about bees on this show, but I want to focus a little bit today on wasps. Somebody said, how are wasps different from bees? And maybe you could start by talking about that.
Well, you can get real technical entomologically, but part of it is just seeming to be the way they kind of work. You know, most wasp species are predators. So they're even though they'll collect nectar, they're out collecting some form of protein to raise their young. Whereas we think of most bees, they use nectar as their energy source, but they collect pollen to feed their young. Mm-hmm. So the food preferences are quite different. You know, we have solitary wasps, meaning that they live individually. They don't have queens per se, but we do have some social wasps, just like the bees, where we have a society that is primarily female. We have a queen or multiple queens in some cases with species that lay the eggs, and the workers are sterile females that basically do all the work of building the colony, feeding the young, and protecting the nest.
And they do get, wasps get a bad rap.
Well, the problem is that twofold, and this doesn't matter if it's bees or wasps. If you disturb the nest, they're very aggressive. But what gets us in trouble with a wasp is they're scavengers, and they need both sugar and protein. And so often if you've got spilled drinks or you're trying to eat a sandwich outdoors and a wasp decides that it wants some of your food, it puts you in very close contact, and that's why we see far more stings from wasps than we typically do bees.
Yeah. You know, SD in Madison has a question that relates to all this. Let's go there. SD, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. So I just had to eliminate two nests, I think is the word, rather than hive, but you can correct me on that, of eastern yellow jackets after they attacked the girl who mows the lawn for me. And I have two questions. One, I think you started talking about, is are they pollinators, or to what degree are they pollinators, and are they important in that way? Because I was aware that I had them, but since they didn't sting anyone until now, I let them be, assuming that they're pollinators, because I see them in squash flowers and so forth.
Sure.
And the second question is, I was just kind of stunned by the beauty of their nests and intricacy and the entryway. It's just amazing, the structures that they build. And now that I believe they're all dead because I haven't seen movement there, is it safe for me to cut into it and look at the inside, or might there be some living individuals there still?
Yeah, it probably would be safe if you see no activity during the day. It turns out that these forms of paper wasps, we have some that make their nests above ground. We have some that make their nests below ground. The below ground ones are particularly problematic because there's just nothing visible. And again, if you put the lawnmower over it, they all get disturbed. And so we see far more problems with these ground nesting ones. And the paper we call carton that they use to make the nest is usually, you know, chewed up leaves or chewed up pieces of wood. Although I remember back, my colleague, Dr. Bob Jean, had students studying, especially German yellow jacket when it moved in the state. And they collected nests on campus, and it was interesting because they were multicolored nests. They had pinks and blues and all these interesting colors, because what the wasps were doing is going on some of the billboards and pulling the poster paper off and using that to make, chew it up and make the nest. And so that gives you an idea of how they work. And, you know, in the species that we have here, they all have to start with a single queen that has spent the winter. She was fertilized the previous fall. And so the colony builds as we go out through the summer, and it will continue to build as long as the weather allows, although typically by the early part of October, they start to decline because food is in short supply. And at that point, you know, usually what we judge if we have to deal with them is if it's a place where people will come into close contact, the threat of them, you know, being bumped into or, again, a lawnmower close to it is such that they should be dealt with. You know, if they're up 20 feet in a tree, it's not worth bothering. And they probably give us the most benefit because they are predators on some various plant-feeding insects. As far as pollinating, more of the solitary wasps I see are probably a little bit more important than the yellow jackets are as far as, and some of the other paper wasps as far as pollinating. They do a little bit, but on the scheme of things, they are definitely not near as important as bees and some of the other critters that are out there. And now, as far as dealing with a nest, I mean, what I always would suggest to folks is if it is visible, you can see the nest, that the aerosol wasp killers work quite well, although the best time to treat is either right in the morning before they kind of get active or at night when they're all home. If you treat in the middle of the day, the problem is the workers that are out and about will come back and become very agitated. They probably will be repelled by the treatment, and so it becomes more risky. In a ground nest or something that goes in a hole in your siding, honestly, I find the aerosols often perform much poor because you're really not sure where the nest is versus where you're treating. And for those, even though it's a bother to work with, it's often better to dust the entrance with an appropriate product, same kind of timing. Or, you know, the other blessing, if not so much now, but when it gets cooler, if the temperature is much below about 45 degrees or so, they're not active. I mean, they just can't get their body temperature up enough to go. So you can treat. But usually if we're that late in the season, I tell people let it be because they die out. They don't, for 95% plus, don't reuse the nest. We do have a European a paper wasp that has moved in that occasionally will reuse a nest, but that is really infrequent. So as I said, you just leave them. But if you want to open them up, it will be fascinating. You will see a comb that might remind you of a honeybee comb, although rather than the honey stored in there, there will be potentially larvae or little caps on it, which mean they are pupae. As I said, you'll find literally hundreds of cells inside a nest.
Oh, very cool. Esty, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And they do some pollinating then?
Again, when they're in there messing around trying to get nectar for an energy source, getting that sugar water, that gives them a chance to, pick up pollen, and then we go to the next plant. You know, it's a mechanical type thing that with most insects, that's what they're about. So
there we go. Thank you, Esty. Patty in Madison, your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. And Esty's questions go into this for sure. I live right next to a schoolyard. There's a sandbox. I hear there's hornets or wasps in that sandbox. A friend wants to do a stealth mission and pour some boiling water into that sandbox or to the whatever they are to kill the nest. Taking a non-chemical approach. This is a schoolyard. It's a Madison Metropolitan School District schoolyard. To me, my deal is just bulldoze that sucker because it's probably a giant litter box at this point. But
part of it is to sort through. If you see all the critters, lots of them going into one hole, then it's one of these ground nesting wasps. And again, with kids around and stuff, that gets it. But there are other types of wasps that utilize sand. And we've got some solitary wasps where each individual wasp will dig a little hole and go out and collect crickets or whatever they're at. You know, it depends on the species, what they're after. And the thing about solitary wasps is they really don't have a nest, and for that reason, they're not aggressive. So it's really less important to deal with them. And they're very much more seasonal, whereas the yellow jackets kind of build as the season goes on. Now, as far as treating it, I've had people call me up and use gasoline and light it on fire and all kinds of things. And honestly, aside from dangerous environmental issues and fire and everything else, it often doesn't work. And the hot water, the question would be, is if the nest is directly underneath and you pour the water, anything above 110 degrees kills an insect. But where it gets problematic, and this goes back to that issue of why ground nests often have to be treated differently, is if the hole is there, but then it takes a right turn, you find that all the hot water goes straight down and the nest could be a foot over to the left and not affected. One of the options might be to consider trying to plug the nest. Again, doing this either right away in the morning or in the evening. It depends how many critters are there. You know, if it's a very big active colony, they'll probably find a way to dig their way out. And so that doesn't necessarily do it. And so it goes back again to treating. You know, there are various dusts out there. There's even pyrethrin, which is an organic product. If you can find a pyrethrin dust, that would be an option if you're looking for something that has no residual. It's just the question of how you apply that dust. And I often find that's the frustration. The stuff that you buy looks like a giant salt shaker, whereas at times you literally have to blow this stuff in. So like if the nest was in the siding of a house, we often have to use a turkey baster or some other device to blow the dust up into the area. But in a nest like this, it's very much out in the open. That would be an option, and there are other chemicals. But the first thing I would see is make sure that it's one of these ground nesting wasps with lots of critters that have to be dealt with if the kids are there versus these other ones that are probably less problematic.
All right.
It might be worth also getting hold of the school grounds people. You know, because they probably have a procedure. I'm sure they have a procedure for dealing with this kind of issue. And again, I would guess Madison schools have a more restricted policy than
most.
General use, because they're usually very sensitive again to the chemical exposure for the kids.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Thanks, Patty. Appreciate it. John in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, John.
I'm a certified arborist. I got a client down in southern part of the county that has very bad wasp gall on a burr oak. What would be the timing for a spray control on that?
It's spring, but honestly, you know, in all the years and watching treatments, things are really tough to predict because, you know, a lot of the systemics that people have tried have been pretty spotty. And you'd really kind of almost have to know the gall and see if you can find some references in the literature to it. But the way it all works for all those species is they're coming on when the tissue is actively growing in the spring. And that's when they lay their eggs in the tissue, and that's what initiates the gall. Now, is this a leaf gall, or is this more of a woody stem gall?
This is a stem gall, and they're entire twigs.
Yeah, and those are the ones, you know, there's one I know as gouty oak gall. There are other ones that I find are really problematic. As I said, you could consider getting a systemic on. And then it's a question of you almost would look at a fall application for something that's got some decent residual to be able to have it uptake in the tree enough. But as I said, generally, a lot of the research I have seen has been disappointing. As far as the results. Now, some of that might be what people's expectations are, because the damaged tissue is going to stay damaged. The question is newer tissue, and can you prevent it? Avermectin, some of those things would be some things at least to look at. The other thing that I have seen is almost an individual tree's susceptibility. Some of the swamp white oak crosses I see, for whatever reason, are highly susceptible to some of these twig galls, whereas you'll see another tree that was planted right next to it that shows you no sign of it. And so, this goes on. We have been wrestling with this my whole career. I remember various types of treatments, and they said that the sad news is, generally speaking, even chemicals that we haven't used in 20, 30 years, they didn't perform back then, and the newer chemicals haven't done much better.
No. There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, our guest today, retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Jane Rotunda, our producer today, and on-air producer Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist. Great to have Phil back. Certainly, if you have questions, I hope you'll call in or email us. We've got some good emails. I want to take a look at a couple of photos of insects that we've gotten here through our emails. Phil, We've got an email from Steve, picture of a bug he thinks, and he needs help identifying. It's a big beetle spotted on Lake Michigan.
So this, it, as far as an entomologist is concerned, is a trophy.
Three inches long?
Yeah, it is a big, showy critter. It is technically called a cottonwood borer. It is a type of longhorn wood boring beetle. And again, as Steve pointed out, it's 3 inches long and white with the black markings. You don't see this very commonly in Wisconsin. When I think of it, if it's more southern states, although it breeds on willow and cottonwood, usually in river bottoms. So we do have some habitat, and I'm sure we've got a couple records of it. But as I said, it's a pretty infrequent specimen here. But if one sees it, it is extremely impressive. That's one of the biggest. It's definitely one of the biggest longhorn wood boring beetles in the United States. And again, with this color tone, it is just a neat critter. As far as the trees are concerned, not important. I mean, cottonwood tends to tolerate a whole lot of activity. So you might see a hole in the side of the tree, but as far as killing the tree and whatnot, that's not what it does.
And Eric emailed a picture, a real pretty picture, maybe a sunflower or something like that, with a bee. An unusual bumblebee, Eric thinks, a brown stripe on it. Any ideas as to what that bee is?
I want to say that this may be the endangered species of Bombus, but I'm not familiar with those enough. It's definitely in the bumblebee genus. And the way we identify them is when you get down to looking at the abdomen, the number of various stripings on it. And most of our species are basically just yellowish, but this one has those orange markings. But right off the top, I'm not, as I said, there's more than one that has orange markings, and I don't know them well enough to tell which one. But that would be worth looking at, just go under bumblebees. And, a site that I often go to when I'm trying to sort through things, it's called Bug Guide. And what it is a database of pictures that people send in that are they're identified. And you can send pictures to them, but more importantly, where it gets problematic is if you know it's a bumblebee, they'll show you a whole bunch of bumblebees and you can match the picture. If you don't know any idea what kind of insect it is, it's such a big database, it's probably not as practical to work with. But that would be the place. Now, also in this picture next to it are a couple soldier beetles. Those are those orange critters with the little black markings. Those are very common this time of the year in flowers of almost anything. They're working with the pollen and the like, and they really don't harm the plants at all. But it's really amazing how many, if you go out in your garden right now, how many soldier beetles you might find there. And they're kind of a late summer kind of critter. So.
I'll have to get out in the garden and take a look. I haven't noticed. Gary in Ween, Wisconsin, it's your turn. What's on your mind?
Well, good morning, Larry, Phil. I just love your show. It's the greatest. You and the
Thank
weather
you.
Guys. And Scott Raven. I have one question and, well, maybe it's two. Last night on the national news, I believe it was ABC, they had a picture of something called like a monster hornet or wasp. And it's supposed to be twice the size of a normal bee. And I wondered if Phil knew anything about that and whatever happened to the killer bees. And then my other question was, I've got a cabin up in Forest County, and when I was visiting the outhouse the other day, there was a spider, and its body was almost the size of like the fingernail on your little finger. And I was wondering what that could be. So thanks much, guys.
All right.
Okay. So killer bees technically are honeybees that have some African genes in them. And the bottom line is they have been introduced, although they're not 100% Africanized bees, in parts of the United States, but it's more of a southern critter. So, we don't see them in Wisconsin or see the genes of them. And the main problem with them is they're just aggressive. If you bother the hive, they're far more aggressive. People get more stings. So, the name killer bee was more of a press name than what the entomologist called it. And now the critter that's getting all the press is these giant killer hornets from Asia. They honestly are really problematic for honeybees because they go into honeybee colonies and just eat everything in sight. And they are not found here at all. It's basically in British Columbia and the state of Washington. There has been some intercepts, and so that's what they're kind of keeping on. And you see about every couple weeks there seems to be a new report, and I think that's what brings it back onto the national news scene. Now, in Wisconsin, we find that we have cicada killers, which are not as big, but it is a large solitary wasp that a lot of people have not seen. And so I know PJ in the lab, and I personally, people have sent me a handful of pictures this late summer of cicada killers. And again, because of its sheer size, it gets people's attention, and they remember the big critter they saw on TV. But giant hornets are not found here. And again, the murder hornet, as they refer to, really is a murderer of honeybees, not so much of people, so that's not much of a concern. Big spider up, you know, when we get big spiders in Wisconsin, they turn out either to be fishing spiders or wolf spiders. And they are among some of the biggest and scariest looking, but pretty much harmless, and so I bet you. In fact, I'd guess fishing spider just because that seems to be, just with the colorful pattern and stuff, it gets people's attention. And as I said, they look terrible, but they're not there. Just real quickly, Larry, back to the bumblebee thing.
Yeah.
You know, the one that we're concerned about is called the rusty patched bumblebee. And I really wonder if that marking's back there. I mean, it really does look like it. And as I said, that is an endangered species. One of the things that's gone on with bumblebees is, you know, we've got probably about 15, 16 species in the state, and a number of them are not native. And so the non-native bumblebees have started really probably established better than in some of our native species have suffered because of habitat loss. And so, as I said, the rusty patched is, I think, even officially designated in Wisconsin as an endangered critter. So that's a pretty neat picture to get a picture of one in an area.
Yeah, for sure. Gary, thanks again. Don in Bayfield, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I'm curious. Spiders do most of their spinning webs at nighttime. How the heck can they see what they're doing in total darkness?
You know, insects have a whole different sensory system than we do. In most spiders, I don't consider very visual. Now, jumping spiders are probably the one example, and if you see a picture of a jumping spider, they have these huge front eyes, and they use that to pick up movement. That's how they get their prey. But most spiders honestly rely on touch and feel more than anything, and so whether it's dark or light out, it really doesn't bother them. They get enough sense of the world and be able to construct things just fine. And, you know, it makes sense biologically to do things at night because you're less likely to get eaten by something. And so I'm sure that is an evolutionary trait that has served them quite well.
Yeah. Thanks, Don. Appreciate it. Barry in Viroqua. We're on to you now. Hi, Barry.
Yes. Good morning.
Morning.
A couple of years ago on NPR, I heard an interview with a person who was saying that worldwide the insect population has dropped by perhaps as much as 40%. And as I drive around the state, I'm noticing a lot fewer bugs on my windshield. So Is that true?
Yes, there were some great scholarly articles that have come out in the last 3 or 4 years, and including articles in the New York Times about this drastic insect population drop. And everybody's been concerned. And, you know, I sit back and, you know, whether we've talked about it on the radio before, there's less cars hitting or bugs hitting my car when I'm driving down the highway, or there's less bugs sitting around the streetlight at night. But a recent study just came out, and I mean recent, within the last week or two, I've seen the references of a number of scientists in the United States who have delved into this and been looking at collections, and their general comment was that overall we have not seen this big reduction. And so I'll be honest, very unexpected because of all the previous types of things. And again, my observation, and maybe it's you know, because I'm getting older, although I seem to like to pay attention to bugs just like I was a kid. Now, a lot of that probably has to do with habitat changes. You know, when I was growing up, our house was kind of on the outskirts, and there was farms and fields and a diverse habitat, which would support a lot more critters versus, you know, a more urban setting where there's a more restricted habitat. And we have a lot of lawns, which entomologically are kind of like deserts and the like. And so I was encouraged because I said it really was disheartening to hear yeah. about it. And again, the ecological consequences. Now, as we're chatting, Larry, I have come across, because I got my computer going, there is a really nice chart of the bumblebees of Wisconsin that is on the internet. And let's see if I can... and what it is again, using this pattern on the back. And it turns out that the picture is not of the rusty patch butterfly or bumblebee, but it looks like it is one that is often called a tricolored bumblebee, among other things. But again, that's a great field guide. And what you're looking at is the pattern on their back and the pattern on their abdomen. And, you know, are there, where are the stripes, where are the dots, all those other things. And they have listed here, it looks like about a 15 species or so, and a couple of them are somewhat variable. So they said there are some good, and this was published by the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade.
All right, the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade, and it's the Bumblebees of Wisconsin. All right. There we go. Let's go to Judy and Racine next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a mosquito question. I don't know if it's my imagination, but it seems to me that the mosquitoes that are biting around in Racine here are much smaller than usual. Is that... Mm.
So,
but they sure know how to bite.
Yeah, we have technically, last I had seen the list, 56 different species. So there are some size differences. But the other phenomena, some of the more aggressive people biters, when their populations are stressed because things are drying out, there's less food, literally the adults are somewhat smaller. And so I'm guessing that's a little bit more of the factor, considering the time of the year. You know, we've got a whole bunch of mosquitoes that are real active in the spring and early on, but we don't see later in the season. The big problem ones, some of the floodwater mosquitoes, they'll breed as long as the weather will allow. And considering, again, we're kind of going towards the drought direction in the last 2 to 3 weeks, I can see where a lot of the breeding sites are starting to dry up, stressing these critters. So I bet you that's what it is. But to be scientific about it, we'd have to see the exact critter to make sure what species, but it fits the pattern of floodwater mosquitoes that are breeding continuously if the weather allows, but also that as things get stressful, the adults are smaller than what they would be if they were under more ideal conditions.
Ah, there you go, Judy. Thank you very much for calling. Well, Dave in La Crosse has a question for you, Phil. Let's go to Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. A few years ago, there was a program to control purple loosestrife by raising some beetles that predated on it. And I just wondered if that program is still going and if how successful it has been.
It's been really pretty successful, hasn't it, Phil?
Yeah, really successful. I don't know. I know the DNR was moving more to working with garden clubs and other groups to help them, you know, where they would send you pots and you could grow the beetles and then release them in some of these problem sites. I guess the way I judge it is more how much loosestrife we used to see versus what we're seeing now, and there's far less of it. So it has knocked that plant down considerably. The one thing I don't know, again, if they're still working with master gardeners and other small groups to introduce it into areas where it's not. But I would venture that most of the problem sites have been identified and they're working on it. And as I said, once those things start to establish, it really does knock down the success of loosestrife in many of these environments.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Dave. Joe in Two Harbors, Minnesota. Hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. Two things. First of all, thanks to Dr. Pelletieri, there's about 5 cabin owners here that now no longer have a problem with cluster flies due to his advice. My number two question situation is, I've got a huge hornet's nest that's surrounded an outdoor light, and I sprayed it twice on 2 different days, and There's still hornets up in there, even though I've busted the nest up. Do you have any suggestions for completely clearing out that huge nest?
Yeah. I think this is the case. Normally, I would think that if you could see the nest, that the aerosol treatments would get it. But it sounds some way or another that they're more sheltered inside that light. This, where we get back to that application of a dust, and again, when you have to blow a dust upwards, it's somewhat problematic. But I would look at, you know, there's a thing you can get at the hardware store occasionally. They call the bulb duster, and it looks like a little bellows. You just kind of fill the reservoir. It's got a little straw, and then when you puff it with your hand, it blows the dust out. But you could do the same thing with a turkey baster. And so the thing about a dust is that the dust kind of settles on the surfaces, and when the hornets are walking through it, they pick it up on their bodies, and that's what gets them. The problem with many of the sprays, they have very little residual. So if you spray the hornet when it's there, it is in big trouble very quickly, much quicker than the dust will kill it. But if they walk on the surface 20 minutes later, it may not be effective at all. And so that's why if you can get the whole nest and get it surrounded and treated, you got them. But if it's in a place you can't get to, that's what I like about the dust, because it kind of keeps working over a period of time. And they have to come and go, and that's when they get it on their person. So that's what I would consider. And it's just a question of, can you find a device? Because dusts are very easy to find, but can you find a device that makes it somewhat practical and easy to get the dust up where you need to get it?
Yeah, there you go, Joe. Thank you. Good luck. Appreciate the call. True in New Berlin. On to you now. Hi, True.
Hi. So the other day down in Muskego, I found this centipede that is like a whitish, bluish, pink, opalescent, almost silvery kind of color. And it wasn't a house centipede. It was one of the ones that's like a large, flat body style. And I was wondering if I found like an albino one, or if it's its own species that just has that color.
Boy, without seeing it, you know, I'm aware of some pretty interesting centipedes, but that one's got, I don't think I've ever seen one that way. And so it may be a species I'm not familiar with. Again, that would be a place that you could go on to Bug Guide and under centipedes and just, you know, get a general view to see if you see something similar. And then the question would be, is if you see something that body structure looks the same but is a different color, then you may have a different color morph. I mean, it does happen in insects and their relatives quite commonly. I've seen pink katydids and other things that honestly you think somebody photoshopped when they send it to you. So it could be. But the bluishness, you know, most true albino stuff would be white, but because of insects in arthropods' cuticle, they reflect light differently, so that doesn't necessarily mean it can't be. The other phenomenon you see with any of the arthropods when they grow is when they molt their skin, often they are a much lighter color, but as the skin starts to harden, they get to their regular color. So in that case, if you saw something that recently molted, it would have, within 2 or 3 hours, change to a more typical color. If it doesn't change, then it sounds like it's part of its character. And then again, is it a species that I'm not aware of, which could be, because there's definitely critters like that out there. or as I said, is it a weird color morph that would we consider quite unusual, but it does happen.
Oh, there you go, True. Thank you for calling. Marilyn in Ellison Bay, on to you now. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning. I have several bluebird boxes that I monitor on the property, and a chickadee nested in one of them and had some little babies in there. The next time that I checked that box, it was full of bumblebees, looking like bumblebees to me at any rate. So I left them alone for quite some time, and recently I peeked in there, and they took the nest, the bird's nest, and totally enclosed it except for a little opening in the front, sort of like a wasp might do. And there were a couple of dead bumblebees in that box. But other than that, I couldn't identify what kind of critter that was or why it would have taken over a nest box.
You know, bumblebees. Well, I mean, typically what they're looking for is a gopher burrow or some other hole in the ground, because they're not really good diggers. But it isn't that unusual to see them in a bird house. I honestly have even found them in a bird nest that they set up housekeeping in there. I was pruning a bush in the front yard one time and ended up getting stung by a bumblebee, and I started poking around, and lo and behold, they had set up housekeeping in an abandoned bird nest. So that's definitely possible. Now, the good news is that bumblebees, like the yellow jackets, will be gone by the mid to late fall, so then you can clean the house out, so it'd be just fine for next year for the bluebirds to become available. And different species of bumblebees, you know, their populations start to decline, some as early as now. Most of them, well, we get into September, early October, they're pretty much done with, and part of it is because when you think about it, we don't have much things flowering. And again, they just like the hornets and yellow jackets, it is only the fertilized queens that overwinter. They hide under a rock or in some other sheltered environment, and then the next spring they start everything from scratch and look for a hole or some other, you know, washed out area under a rock to set up their nests. And bumblebees tend to be far smaller colonies. You know, we're talking 30 to 50, whereas, you know, the yellow jackets, we can have 3,000 or 4,000 individuals or more in a nest in the late summer.
Mm. Marilyn, thank you very much for calling. Barb in Green Bay emailed kind of along these lines of Marilyn. She's having trouble refilling the grape jelly for the orioles during the day because the bald-faced hornets or bull wasps swarm around the jelly. They never had that problem until 2 or 3 years ago. Have they recently moved into northern Wisconsin, or have they always been there and just found their oriole feeder? Can you discourage them?
Boy, so they are native, so it's not that they really moved as much. And, you know, each year it's a new, quote, colony, but if there are colonies in the area, it's not surprising that there are some foraging. This gets really tough. You know, it's much like, again, hummingbird feeders. We have the same problem. And there are some designs of hummingbird feeders that tend to be very restrictive in how much sugar water is available to non-hummingbirds. And so it's just a design problem. I don't know if there's something similar I'm thinking probably not, but if somehow you could divide the grape jelly is available to the birds, but harder for the wasps to find it. The problem is that bald-faced hornets and yellow jackets, much like honeybees, when they find a food source, they are capable of communicating to their nest mates that there's a food there. We knew that about bees for a long time. We weren't aware of that until they studied the behavior of wasps closer. And as they said, they get in the habit, and that becomes where it's problematic, is they just keep coming back because they expect food to be there.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Great to have him by, and thank you for listening in. Lots of questions, lots of calls, lots of emails, Phil. Here's one from Emily, who emailed wondering what she can do about spruce budworm. They live in Hermansville, Michigan. It's Menominee County in the UP, and this is the first year they've encountered spruce budworm, and they don't know what to do.
Sure. So it's an insect that gets in outbreak populations on occasion. And honestly, for very big trees, if they're assaulted for 2 or 3 years in a row, it can even be life-threatening. But the good news about it is typically when their populations go up, it's just a matter of time before various beneficial predators and parasites show up and knock the populations out. So it's one of these things, if you've got 20 acres of woods and they're in there, you almost have to just let it run its course. You know, historically in big outbreaks, they have done aerial applications of treatments and whatnot, but that really isn't done much anymore. On the other hand, if it is a small tree that is in your front yard, that, you know, for cosmetic reasons and others, you would like to salvage it, they can be treated, but we're treating them in basically May and June. As the name implies, that the little larvae are burrowing into the buds as they're developing in the spring. And so an application in May with various products would be very effective. It's just a question, again, of the situation. You know, small ornamental trees, yes. Large trees, it would be difficult to spray. It's better to let it run its course. And as I said, typically, maybe a couple years bad in most scenarios, and then they seem to disappear.
Let's take a call from Ed in Northern Illinois next. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. I have a question regarding the mosquito spraying services for lawns.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So I live in a semi-rural housing development, and my neighbors around me have these services come in and spray. And then they come back with comments like, oh, I don't see very many lightning bugs. And I'm wondering, are we actually sterilizing the environments that these are sprayed into, you know, sure. Because it's a two-part chemical. One is a pyrethrin that kills instantly, and the other is a residual.
Right, and the residual is what gets us into trouble. So the way I approach this, you know, if somebody said, you know, we're going to have an outdoor wedding and the mosquitoes are bad, I think it's reasonable for somebody to come in once, a couple days before, and put an application on. Because, you know, it will be fine for the guest. And we don't get into these bigger ecological concerns on a single treatment. But the problem when you start putting a residual insecticide into the environment multiple times is that many non-target things get affected. And I will tell you, we know for a fact that using chemicals that frequently will literally cause upsets. It causes mite problems. It can cause even some of the pests to do better because sometimes some of the beneficial insects are more sensitive to the chemicals than to than the pests that we're trying to fight. And so, as I said, I understand people's frustrations. And in what you tend to find is, you know, in wet years when the mosquitoes are ridiculous, it helps somewhat, but it doesn't get them all. In dry years, they look like heroes, but there's no mosquitoes anyway. And so, regular applications of any kind of residual in a lawn is, over the long run, asking for other problems on your ornamental plants and the like. And again, you're affecting some of these non-targets. So I'm not, you know, the pyrethrum argument is that it's a quick residual that kills what's there and there's nothing left. But that would mean that the mosquitoes could blow in tomorrow, and now you got mosquitoes again. And so that's why they're using these residual products. And some of them, upwards of 3 weeks worth of residual. And again, boy, dosages and selection of chemicals somewhat affect what insects will be susceptible or not. But the bottom line is residual insecticides constantly in environment are not a good thing.
All right. There you go, Ed. Keith in Forest County, on to you now. Hi, Keith.
Good morning, and thank you for Professor Pelletier. I always enjoy his programs. I have a question that's probably on the borderline of what would qualify for this program. I've been told it's a virus, so if a single strand of RNA counts as a bug, here I go. It's been called witch's broom, and it's a big growth that seems to be like a mutation on the coniferous trees up here. I'm looking at one right now. It's about twice the size of a basketball, and it looks like a whole bunch of mutant coniferous needles all clasped together. Are you familiar with this, and is this something we can talk about?
Well, honestly, Brian Huddleston would be, the plant disease specialist would be a better person. But just in general, the term brooming, is kind of this proliferation of tissue, and there are cases like in honeysuckle that an aphid causes it. Different maladies that are called brooms could either be insect-related or plant disease related and the like. And again, this is a plant disease. So unfortunately, I am not the person to talk to.
If you take a photo of it, Keith, and send it to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, if you type that into a search engine, it's going to come up. And Brian, who Phil was talking about, we'll be able to give you some more information about it. I'm almost positive. If you can get a reasonable close-up, would be helpful. So there you go. Thank you so much. Dawn in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you so much for taking my call, Larry. Your show is such a treasure. Thank you so much for it.
Thank you.
So the other day, my daughter and I found this beautiful, what we thought was a caterpillar inside of our house, directly above our fiddle leaf fig. Now, my husband looked it up, and it turns out that it was a bumblebee millipede. It was maybe 3-4 inches long. Total beauty, just the most lovely creature. After we looked it up, we found it's not native to the area at all. So I was just sort of curious how you think it ended up in our house. Could it maybe have been a passenger on the fig? Or do you just see them in the area from time to time?
Yeah, I have seen a number of interesting critters coming up on tropical plants and the like. Coming in, and that would be my first inclination. If again your research suggests that it's not found here, but I have seen said numerous things, and sometimes not even on plant products. I've seen scorpions coming out of TV boxes and those kind of things. So you do get stuff transported in, and that would be. How long have you had the plant though?
About a year now.
Boy, that seems like a lot. One thing that would have surfaced before that, and I wonder if there's some other potential. Any other plant material you brought into the property in the last 6 months or so?
A chenille plant, but I don't think it's been anywhere near. It's been on a completely different floor of the house, so it would have had to have some pretty good hustle to get up where I found it.
Interesting. Very interesting. That one, if you had a picture, it would be worth sending it to PJ at the diagnostic lab just so he can put it kind of as a reference, because seeing odd things like that, it kind of makes our day just because. But is a way that we often track some of this stuff. If I ever do finish my book, about two-thirds of it is records of things that I witnessed when I was running the lab, kind of new things and watching them unfold, which is both very intriguing, but also, as one would expect, kind of frustrating because some of these things we don't want.
Yeah, for sure. So the Insect Diagnostic Lab, in UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, Don, if you have a photo of that, send that in to PJ for sure. Thank you so much for calling. Janet in Madison.
There you go, Larry. Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. I have yet another yellow jacket question for you. It is the season after all. I have a tree in the yard and underneath is a bed with hostas and stuff. And I did find that there was a nest in the ground there. And I was told by someone that you could shove a hose in there and let it sort of run or trickle for a long time. So I tried that and let it run for, gosh, I'm embarrassed to admit, about 2 days. And I think all it did was tick them off. I would have thought that would drown the nest. So I read online and somebody else said, cover the hole with a piece of screen and tamp it down and hold it down with rocks. And then, so then I did that last night with full body armor and sprayed almost an entire can of wasp Raid that a neighbor gave me. And then I squeezed a bunch of dish soap in there and then put the hose on it and filled it up until it overflowed. I left the screen on and I put a rock over the screen over the hole. And I went out there this morning, and there's still wasps, about 4 of them buzzing around the area. Yeah. Normally, I'd love to just let them be, but I've been stung multiple times now these last 2 weeks, and I've got to do something. Do you think that did anything?
No, I probably – okay, so going back to the original flooding – again, if they're using an old gopher burrow or whatnot, they're often constructed in a way that they don't flood out. And again, it's just a question of if the chamber goes off to the side, everything is soaking downward, and so that often is why we see it doesn't work. And again, the same thing with the aerosols is that you're soaking the entrance, but the nest technically could be a foot away or more, just depending on how that burrow looks. Now, with what you've done with the soap and stuff, I mean, soapy water will kill them if you can get it to them. What I'm suspicious of is you probably knocked them out pretty good, but I'm wondering if when you're doing your treatments, again, there were individual workers that were out foraging out, and now they come back, they can't get in the hole, they're all confused, and they're somewhat agitated. In those circumstances, though, what you see within a day or two, either it's going to get much worse, which they've survived and they've dug a new hole to come and go on, or, again, they will just kind of peter out because the colony is wiped out. So it's best to just kind of stay away from the area a little bit the next couple days, just watch. And then when you go, you don't want to go with it, any kind of lawnmower, anything that creates a ruckus, but you can often sneak relatively close and just observe. And what I'm looking for is enough activity that it gets your attention. And then what it would be important is to, what is it, a crack or a hole that they've opened up? And the next line of defense would be, like we've talked about before, is using a dust in that entrance and treating it either, in the evening or right away in the morning, and let them go. There are certain circumstances where it's problematic to fill the hole in if they can find their way out. And not so much in the ground, but where I get these problems is if the nest is in the siding of somebody's home, and they see them coming and going, so I think the way they'll get them is to stuff the hole. What you find is the yellow jackets are in the wall, then now can't find their way out that way, so they start coming through light fixtures and around baseboards and other things and really become problematic.
So there you go, Janet. Thank you so much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us, and then we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus from UW-Madison. Great to have him along today, and thanks so much for tuning in. Have you been having an insect problem or maybe just a question about insects? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email at ideas@wpr.org. Carly in Brooklyn, Wisconsin, has a question for you, Phil, so let's go there. Hi, Carly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We live in Brooklyn, and we have a field adjacent to our house that unfortunately had a case of wild parsnip. And I've noticed over the last few days or few years that the number has gone down, and I've noticed some kind of insect like weaving some kind of web around the flower of the wild parsnip. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's a caterpillar or a spider, like I'm not sure, but I'm wondering if that could be the reason that it's the numbers sure. of plants are going down and what that could possibly be.
So they call the critter a parsnip webworm. And it is a caterpillar. It turns into a relatively small moth, and that's its claim to fame. It gets in the flower heads and feeds, which reduces the number of seeds, which technically should reduce the populations. Now, as you know, parsnip's doing quite well in a lot of places, so it isn't the cure-all, but if it's active, that's a very good sign. And as I said, if you look it up, parsnip webworm, it's all it feeds is on a parsnip, and usually feeds in little colonies. That's not that unusual for various species of webworms. And even full-grown, the caterpillar is not much more than half an inch, so they're not really very big.
All right, Carly, there you go. Thank you. Rick in Bell Center, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Question for Bill. So, 2 weeks ago, I discovered a ground nest with a lawnmower, and it had an opening of about a quarter. And so I stayed away from it, came to check on it, and the opening was about four.
Oh, we lost... We're losing you, Rick. Rick found a wasp nest in the ground.
Is the entrance is opened up, which often is a sign that skunks or raccoons are trying to dig into the nest, which is quite common because there's all these little grubs in there which make great food, great protein source. So that is not that unusual, and skunks in particular seem to tolerate the stings. So I'm just guessing that was the direction he was going with it. Now, again, if it had to be dealt with, that it hadn't gotten all chewed on by the skunks, then using a dust in that entrance would be a way of doing them in. But this happens quite common. People are not aware of a colony being active, especially if it's a place there's not much traffic, until all of a sudden the skunks come in and tear things up, getting after the grubs.
Yeah, there we go. Barb in Sabisky, your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hi, I'm calling about, we have a log home, and I have, so it's been treated, you know, with stains and whatnot over 25-year period. And I have on the outside, is it powder post beetles or post powder?
Powder post beetles.
Beetles that leave, yeah, powder post beetles. And everything I've found is that they are untreatable if you've already have stain, and mine's a pretty solid stain now.
Well, there's one other thing to look at here, because it can be confused. So it turns out that in most logs, there are pre-existing holes from bark beetles and other things that are in there. And that environment will be a place that there's various small bees and wasps will get into. And it almost looks like powder post beetle, because you see a hole in the wood and you see a little bit of sawdust on occasion coming out. That itself is not a structural problem. I mean, it's just they're utilizing an environment. And technically, I could say, well, if you really wanted to get rid of it, if you plugged all the little holes with a little putty or some other device, that would shut that down. Now, true powder post beetle typically goes after wood. And under the right conditions, and usually the conditions, the more moisture, the happier they are, they will get in the wood. And one of the standard treatments is to use a borate treatment. The trouble with the borate is if it's sealed, it doesn't soak in the wood. If it doesn't soak in the wood, it doesn't work. But before, you know, you got a lot of time to assess this. I would make sure that what you're seeing is truly powder post beetle. You might consider marking a little area where you see the holes, count the holes, plug them, do whatever. But what we're looking is the existence of new holes, which would suggest powder post beetle. Whereas if you don't see anything else being active in that area, then it's just, again, one of these wasp species or bee species utilizing old bark beetle holes in the logs. And as I said, I think it's worth assessing what's going on. Now, if you had to treat it, it's true. The problem is you almost have to strip off the outer ceiling to get the borates in. But I'm leaning towards more, it might be the wasp and bee issue that, said it, on the surface it looks like powder post beetles, but it's not.
Yeah, there you go. We have some photos emailed into us, Phil. We had a listener email two photos of insects. Both look like beetles, maybe? One's bright green, the other is orangish color.
Okay, which name? Because I've got quite a few here.
Well, it just says a listener emailed two photos. They've got a bright green. That would have come in at about 11:29 or so.
Okay, let me see if I can pull up on that one, because I... Okay, the first critter is a tiger beetle, which is related to our ground beetles. But tiger beetles are typically metallic color. They're predators. Usually you find them in open areas like sandy beaches and sometimes in kind of paths in the woods. Real neat critters, real quick. When you see them fly, they're really quite difficult to get close enough to take a picture or to capture. But those are really neat. And there's some blue species and various forms of them, and we have a number of species in the state. The second critter I know under the grape leaf beetle is one of the names it's given. It is a type of scarab, so it's related to June beetles. Feeds a little bit on grape leaves, but really doesn't do much. I think the grubs are found in rotting stumps. The underside of that critter, honestly, has some metallic sheen to it, so it's kind of attractive. In this family of scarab beetles, there are a number of really neat-looking beetles. Most of them are more tropical, but this is one in Wisconsin that really is quite attractive if you like beetles.
And then just below that photo, Sharon in Menominee emailed kind of a really cool picture, too, of a spider.
Right. So that one is called the shamrock spider, is the common name. It is technically an orb weaver spider, which are real common in the late summers. It's typical. Many of them are very colorful. They often have banding patterns in the legs, light and dark. But some of them can be quite ornate or, you know, colorful, this pinks, oranges, yellows. And what you usually see are the large females that will make a egg sac, and that's how the spider gets through the winter. And again, they're common in the late summer, and they make these big webs. Charlotte's web is really after one of the species, one of the barn spiders is the famous critter in that one. But orb weavers are common in the late summer, and again, harmless, but because they're so showy, they definitely get people's attention.
Yeah, and just one more before we go back to the phones. Kathleen emailed two pictures, some sort of bee she needs help identifying. Is it a bald-faced hornet? She also saw a dragonfly on the sidewalk 2 days ago that was unique to her.
So the dragonfly is called a saddleback, is one of the names it's given, and it is one of, we have a number of species. And the critter in the middle is a bald-faced hornet. They are about twice the size of the normal yellow jacket, and rather than being a distinct black and a yellow striping, the markings are more of a light cream color on them.
Uh-huh.
And these are the ones that make the huge nests up in the trees. So, you know, it often gets people's attention. And there is a New England tradition that the distance of the nest off the ground is going to predict the snowfall of the year. I will tell you, in my career, I found that there was no truth to that at all. So,
okay. Terry and Roberts has heard various stories regarding how Asian beetles came here, and he wonders, what's the true story, and how do you get rid of them?
Okay, so the dilemma. It's one of these things that if you get into it, the stories you read often have half-truths. So the most common misconception is that they were brought into the United States to control soybean aphids. The problem is the first Asian lady beetles were caught in the late 80s down in New Orleans, and soybean aphid was not discovered until the year 2000 in Wisconsin, by the way, in the Lake Geneva area. Now, where the confusion is that back even as early as the 1920s, Asian lady beetle was imported as a biological control for various pest species, and they were never successful. You know, they tried it. We've had other cases where this has been very beneficial. But our success rate is less than 10% in these kind of things. And one could argue that was probably not a wise decision even then, because this is a general predator. It feeds on a wide variety of things. And so I've read papers where they are feeding on monarch eggs and baby caterpillars. And, you know, so they're eating a bunch of things you don't want them to, which is what you expect from a general predator. Now, their claim to fame is that in the fall they invade your house. And again, there's some misconceptions there because of the soybean association. People believe that you get them because you got a soybean field next to you. We find that is not really much of a factor. Who gets them depends a lot on how your house is located. If you have a beautiful house sitting up on a ridge with a great southern exposure, you can be drawing beetles in from huge distances.
Long way away.
That same house in the same design, and you put it in the middle of the woods where it doesn't get this southern exposure and that real light that we're all after, the beetles don't find your house. You know, so there's a real visual thing. And the cue to them to start to come in is typically we get into September and October when you get the first hard freeze. Then you get those beautiful sunny 60 degrees plus days afterwards. That's when they start looking for shelter. In nature, they nest under rock facings up in the crevices of rocks, and that's apparently the visual picture they're getting when they see the side of your house. So the argument is, if you know where they're coming in and you seal things tight enough so that they can't get in the house, you've won the war. But you've got to check all your vents, your soffits. You know, sometimes this is practical. If you got an old farmhouse, you're going to laugh at me because there's just too many cracks and crevices to seal. So then the other option, and this is only a temporary fix, is there are sprays that can be applied either commercially or you can buy them yourself. They're basically versions of various barn sprays, fly sprays, that are put on the outside structure middle of September to middle of October before you get that hard freeze that starts sending them in. And what it will do is it will both repel them and stop them from getting in and in some cases kill them. if you wait to the 1st of November and they're already in your walls or your attic, it doesn't matter what you do because you can't have access to them. So it's not even worth bothering. So again, if you've had a house that you can't seal up, you've had a reoccurring problem with this, it's a little hard to predict how bad they will be, but I will tell you from my perspective, when they first got here in the late 90s, they were far worse than they are now. People, but you know, that's relative. Instead of 10,000, you only got 1,000 in your house. I'm telling you how many have went away, but you're still disappointed about the numbers. But you know, that is it. The structural sealing of things and before they come in the fall is the best long-term solution. If that's not available, as I said, if you want to do something, then the application of something in the fall is the best time. Treating them in the spring and other times is worthless. It doesn't do anything. Killing them in the spring doesn't prevent what's going to come the next fall type of thing. So, as I said, if you're going to contract for service, that's what you're looking for, somebody that can treat the outside of the house in that window between mid-September and mid-October.
Jody in Richland Center will give you a chance now. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Larry and Phil. This may be more of a medical question, but I have something feeding on me during the night, and it happens every June and July, and I don't have, it's not bed bugs, it's not fleas, I know what those look like, but these bites swell up, and they're on my legs and my feet, they swell up to almost 3 centimeters, and they blister, and then they scab over. I know this sounds very vulgar, but I'm just wondering, could this be a spider?
No. Spiders, we find, get blamed for a lot. Multiple bites is never spiders. And true spider bites are really quite unusual, and you wouldn't expect them reoccurring. So just a couple thoughts. Because of the time of the year, my first thing would be, well, boy, that sounds like maybe black flies. But if it was black flies, I would expect you to get more bites up around the ears and the neck. The other possibility that would be very seasonal is chiggers. And chiggers are little mites, and they live outdoors. And the problem is that when you're out working an area, they literally come, and many of them are insect parasites by nature. They don't know the difference, so they burrow into people, and then they leave. But honestly, the debris they leave behind causes this reaction that might show up 2-3 days after your exposure. One of the typical things about chigger bites is they often are confined where clothing is restricted, so along the sock line, along the shoe line, sometimes along the belt line, you get it. Women often, right, you know, where the bra meets the skin is often where they seem to start the burrowing. And very weepy, some people, you know, it might be a 3-week or more reaction to them. But the problem is no matter what you do, they've already done their damage and left before you discover it. So as I said, in the scheme of things, even though it might feel like you're getting them at night when you sleep, I wonder if the real reaction might be an exposure during the day or even a day or two before that. That would be my first guess.
There you go, Jody. Thank you. Jennifer in Fond du Lac, on to you now. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So the other day, or actually about a month ago, on my window, I live out in rural Fond du Lac, and I saw the most interesting insect that was worm-like. It had spider legs and wings. It had wings on it, and then a tail or a pointer on it that was so sharp. It was probably the insect, it had a worm body, and it was the most interesting thing I'd ever seen. And I looked it up, and I think I'm pronouncing it, I don't know, but it was an ovipostor or ovipostor, something like this.
Okay, ovipostor is technically an egg-laying device that many insects have, but so my first guess, because there's a lot of insects that do that, I would look under horntail because there is a wasp-like species that has a cylindrical body, has wings, and it has this egg-laying device that somebody would say it's a stinger, but it doesn't use this to sting people. What it does is uses it to lay eggs into wood, and then its grubs develop in the wood. So that would be my first, from your description, wondering if it's a horntail. Now, there are other species that have ovipositors that they use to lay eggs in other insects. In fact, one of the more impressive insects we have in the state is a parasite of this horntail, where the stinger-like device is honestly 2 inches long and curled. And it uses this to drill into the wood to lay its egg to go after the grub from the horntail. But as I said, my first guess would be horntail. And if that's not it, it hopefully will get you in the direction of some other similar-looking insects that it might fit.
There you go, Jennifer. Chuck in Juneau. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I've heard a couple of people comment on ground bees, trying to get rid of them.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I haven't listened to the whole show, so I don't know, maybe somebody already called in with this remedy. But I live out in the country in an old farmhouse, and when we moved in, we had a problem with ground bees in the foundation. And they were coming and going like crazy, especially later in the season, from one particular hole in the foundation. And then a couple years later, we had the same thing. And a hole out in the front yard, just a little round hole about an inch in diameter, maybe a little less. And they were coming and going like crazy out of that hole. What I did is I used a shop vac with a filter in it, and, you know, just a regular filter, and set the shop vac right next to the hole and set the hole for the shop vac sucking right exactly next to the hole. And I just let the thing run. And after a couple of days, I shut it off and looked in there, and there were literally thousands of bees in that shop vac. And I just did that a few more days, and they're gone. Both times I got them that way.
It's working. In fact, honestly, we don't see it. Many pest control firms don't have the equipment or the time to do that, but that is a potential non-chemical treatment that people can use. It's just a question if you want the shop vac running for that long. But, yeah, no, that definitely is a potential option. You know, as we had talked about, for these ground nesters, if you had to go the other way, I don't like sprays as much as I do dust, just because they tend to perform better. So that's another option. But yeah, nothing wrong. What you don't want to do is open the shop vac up when they're still alive in the chamber. and that's been a question sometimes of how do you deal with that, and it you know that gets kind of complicated. But if it's sitting out in the sun and whatnot. It probably heats up enough in there that does them in. The other thing is that the dust that's accumulated in there, dust honestly has quite a bit of insect toxicity issues to it. And so they probably die much quicker than you would expect, either, again, because of the heat or because of the dust accumulation on their bodies.
Yeah. And one more quickly, somebody's wondering about magnolia scale. How's it looking this year? Some years are better than others.
Yeah, it's been relatively bad. In fact, I talked to PJ this morning, and he said that was an issue that was well worth bringing up. And the thing about magnolia scale is they bloom in July, so it looks like you got cotton candy infesting your thing, but that's not the time to treat. The proper window to treat the foliage is to treat it in September. So this is a late season treatment. And this is the same with any scale. You have to know what the species is to know when the window of treatment is. And if you treat this in September, you're killing the young scales that are much easier to kill, whereas you treat it other times of the year, they're very difficult to kill.
On that note, we are out of time. Phil, thank you so much for joining us today. I look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good.
And that new book.
someday.
All right. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW. He'll be back. We'll talk with him again. Tomorrow at this time, Jim Ward is back to talk about the importance of the 5,000-mile or 6-month oil change and, of course, answer your vehicle maintenance questions. In the meantime, I hope you stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.